Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother James, to those who are called, beloved in God, and to Belinda. I mean, oh, excuse me, that's wrong. Some verses.
Do you not have a DVR? What are you missing?
We are covering, once again, the middle chapters. We're covering chapters 5 and 6 tonight, maybe 7. 5, 6, and 7. So we're going to take a lot tonight. Actually, we're not going to cover any of it. We're going to read 5, 6, and 7 and then discuss what he possibly is referring to. And then we'll come back and discuss what he says. Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all. So we know he wasn't talking to us, right? That's an interesting way. We'll come back to that. Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saving the people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe, and angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under the darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulge in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. So, rather than talk about all the aspects here and what he's doing with these three stories, I thought tonight we'd just discuss these references. And so it talks about, and not really, it doesn't even, it's really interesting, it doesn't really define him. He just says a people. But that a people is surely Israel. And so you have the whole book of Exodus as a time when they were brought out, delivered out of this. And so this whole delivering them is basically as Exodus is how they were delivered. But he says after they were delivered, he then turned around and destroyed them because they didn't believe. And in Numbers, we have this account, if I can find it. If somebody knows where it's at, then we can get there. There. Huh? Now, in Numbers, where are we at in Numbers? Need the spies in Numbers, and I didn't have time to... I'm sorry? Wow. I'm impressed. 7 verse 14. One gold pan of 10 shekels, full of incense. No, that's not the, right one. When the spies are sent out.
Spies?
Yep. And I should know it, but I can't think of it.
In Leviticus?
Numbers. Isn't it in Numbers? That could be in the wrong book altogether.
Sounds like
20, somewhere in 20. I'm not prepared, that's for sure. I was going to leave practice early. Well, I don't know. Don't put a question mark. I need statements. Thank you. Yay! Okay, chapter 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourselves men, so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." So, first, prior to even Moses being on the scene, Abraham had already been told that the promised land, it was the promise to Abraham. And actually, Abraham goes there. But then... through the descendants with Joseph, when Joseph is taken to Egypt as a captive, and then the famine, they end up moving back from this land, or not back, but they end up moving out of this land to Egypt. And then after the famine had was over and so forth, they just ended up staying there. Joseph and dies, and the family stays there. But in that time there, in the next 400 years, they grow into this multitude of a couple million people. And so with Moses, they're going to the promised land. So that's where they're going. But so now they're at the borders to go in, and God says, "We'll send in spies." Really, spies is probably the right. Scouts is probably the more appropriate. I'm not sure that they were spying in any sense. They're more scouting. You know, this wasn't really an under that type of an undercover thing. But they go through this. Well, then the let's see. So, verse 21. So they went up and spied out the land. From this place to that place, and it goes through all this. And verse 25, when they returned from spying out the land at the end of the 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to call the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness. So they call everybody together, and they got everybody all together, and they say in verse 27, thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." And so they had all this, you know, produce they brought behind. "Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev and the Hittites and the Jebusites, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." It goes through this. And they're basically saying, hey, you know, everything we heard is true. This place is abundant. It is just, you know, it's just wonderful. Except they got serious warriors there. And they even have giants. And they got fortified cities. You know, so we change it to ours. Let's not, man, that place, they've got, you know, they got fruit trees, they got deep oil wells, they got great water supply, they got one, you know, cattle on a thousand hills, but they also have some MiGs, and they've got some tanks, and they got a lot of army people, and we don't want to fool with them. And that was, so it's this really strange deal of like, it's exactly what God said. However, there's also these people there that we're afraid of. So in verse 30, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him, and they, remember there were 12 that went, and so we have two. Caleb is the main spokesman here at this point, but also Joshua. So you have 2 against 10, basically. You have a majority report and a minority report. And so the majority speaks up again and said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So, you know, the bad report is, it doesn't matter how wonderful it is. Doesn't matter how beautiful it is. Doesn't matter how many grapes there are, or how many fig trees there are. Those people are just too powerful for us. And that was it. Now, you can ask all kinds of questions, you know, in terms of what has this group experienced? And, you know, it's one of those, I mean, there is that part that you really just in a super, super way, want to be critical of all these people. It's like, idiots, you saw the Red Sea part, you saw this. And then at some level you realize, we're not really a whole lot different. You know, would I have acted differently? Not a whole lot to point to that. But let's just go through it from not, you know, not the standpoint of would we have been different, but just looking at what they had going. What are some of the things? I already mentioned the Red Sea. But prior to the Red Sea, I mean, even before they left, you have all these plagues, and they were protected from them. But starting, you know, with the Red Sea, which is, you know, this phenomenal event, they experienced that. What were some other things they've experienced that we're aware of? Okay. I don't know if the manna hasn't really, I don't think the manna started yet.
The water.
The manna, I think the manna starts after... After this, because of the...
But the water, for sure, has happened twice.
Okay, so remember they...
Bitter waters are turned to sweet by throwing in it.
Yeah, so you come to this, you know, and it's not very long after the Red Sea. They're walking along there, and all of a sudden, you know, there's no water. And they're like, you just brought us out here to die. And they come up on this, you know, place that has wet stuff, but it's not... You can't drink it, and... Like everybody knows, you just throw a tree in it, it makes it good. So I mean,
and God's provided quail.
He's
not the one that wants, but he's
yeah. There was their food. So anyway, we
talking about the manna not being.
No,
yeah.
It's also before.
Is it?
I just taught Exodus, so it's.
So what else? But you read that Pullman Bible.
I know, and it's, you know what? And it says scouted out the land.
Hey, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
But for the old English. It was a spyglass.
Ah, spyglass. There you go. And but anyway, they have, and we've had the Ten Commandments. They've had Moses up on the mountain. You've already seen the problem, you know, when they created their golden calf. You've already had those people that have perished with God's judgment there. I mean, it's not as though they've never seen God act. Now, so, yep. So if we, and I don't mean this to be irreverent, but if we were to have something like that happen, I'll say it's the same thing that we have some revelation that we're supposed to go, you know, conquer the building across the street, and so David gets his spyglass out and looks over there and says, hey, you know, there are springs over there. They are loaded with springs. It is the greatest springs you've ever seen. and you know, and we go, yeah, but there's a fence. You know, we can't get across. The gate's locked. Now the you definitely have to. Have paid attention to what kind of company it is to enjoy that, whatever that was. But, and this is where I want to be careful, because I'm not trying to say you haven't experienced God, you don't have convictions that God has done something, but we don't have these type of experiences. I mean, you haven't had... You know, your leader go up in a mountain for 40 days and come back with stone tablets that were written on and a glowing face. You haven't seen a person stand before a sea and hold up a staff and it divide and walk, and you personally walk across dry ground. And then when you get on the other side, it come back in and you know, wipe out an army. I mean, and so I'm not trying to say we don't have our beliefs and our convictions that God has worked in our life. I'm not trying to say that. I'm saying they had concrete examples. So they've experienced things that we've never experienced. And yet, when they see the cities that are fortified, and they see the size of the people, they see that they are warriors, in which... These are not warriors. These were slaves. They're not warriors. They say, we can't do it. We can't do it. So, you have some of these things. You know, okay, yeah, you can kind of understand, because they weren't warriors, why they're saying, hey, those are fortified cities. Those people, you know, those are the Marines over there. I'm not, you know, I don't even know how to shoot a gun. But on the other hand, they've seen God act. They've seen God wipe out the most powerful army that the world knows of just by Moses moving his staff, you know. But these 10, that's where they're standing. And Caleb, and we know it's Joseph or Joshua too, are saying, that's not where we should be. Well, chapter 14, it says, then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. Now, they're crying and weeping because they thought they were going to go on the promised land, and they're in agreement. Yeah, we can't go. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we have died in the land of Egypt, or would that we have died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of, where he is, of those who spied out the land tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into the land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Boy, I mean, you know, it's pretty phenomenal what he's saying there. Not, you know, him, you know, he is not denying what the others. It's not one of these reports where it's like, those guys weren't that big. He's saying, they're, you know, their radar has been jammed. Their, you know, that armor they have isn't going to be any good because we have armor-piercing bullets. I mean, it's like their protection is taken away. And I mean, Joshua, you know, he's got a totally different perspective. Him and Caleb here. And notice he says, "Do not rebel." You see, when we read this, is that rebellion? There's that tendency, I think, on our part to say, "Well, they're just afraid." I mean, they're, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, they're just people. I mean, they heard the report of the 10. The 10 said, oh, we can't do it. The people are just, but, you know, Caleb or Joshua here says, that's rebellion. But all the congregations said to stone them with stones. I love that. I mean, it's not just no or get out of our way, quit talking. It's like, hey, let's kill these guys. We want new leaders. Get rid of those leaders. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. The Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make them into a nation greater and mightier than they. Excuse me. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it, for by your strength you brought up this people from their midst, and they will tell it to their inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people. For you, O Lord, are seen eye to eye while your cloud stands over them, and you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you also have forgiven people from Egypt even until now. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times. So at this point, you could go back and find basically 10 interventions, you know, like the Red Sea, the watering thing, the calf, etc. They shall by no means see the land which I swore to their father, nor shall any of those who spurn me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. So, and then it gets a little more, you know, specific in 28 and 29. He says, your corpses shall fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to the complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not go into the land. And then the next day they all say, hey, let's all gather at the river and cross it, and it's too late. So anyway, that's the setting. There are a lot of times when they didn't believe. He's already makes a reference to 10 times of testing. But when you come down to why did the people, and I forget, this is basically, it's like a year and a half at this point from when they left Egypt. And it's, I heard somebody say once it was, it's only this little, I forgot what it is, so many days walk across there, it took them 40 years. Well, that's really not accurate. It may be just that many days walk across there, but that was never the intention, because they went to Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments came, and they camped out there for a long time, and the Lord, organized them, put them together. This is how you're going to function. And then they trek over to...
Well, they had to build the tent of meeting and all of those.
So it has all these things of how we're going to be organized. This is who we are as a people. And then they get to the river, and this is... So really, it should have taken them like a year and a half to enter into the Promised Land, something like that. But at this point, and I think in Jude it says for their unbelief, in Numbers, clearly unbelief is there. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But it's not simply unbelief. I mean, that thing of non-believing, we, by our usage, we have, unbelief is a passive thing. I mean, you don't do something actively to not believe. You just don't believe. Cincinnati's going to beat Oklahoma this week. Somebody says, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. It's not like you work up something. Biblically, unbelief, that's not unbelief, though. And you can find that, I think it's in Thessalonians. Then we look at that passage in 2 Thessalonians where it has those who disobeyed the gospel. So we talk about people, they're unbelievers, but if we wanted to, we could use 2 Thessalonians, and we'd never talk about those who are unbelievers. We'd be talking about the disobedient. That's a much more active, when you're disobey as opposed to simply not believing. Well, Caleb and Joshua in here, they put it in terms of rebellion. So clearly they didn't believe that God either could or would provide for them. And Caleb and Joshua both are very clear that, hey, God said we could have it, so we can have it. He's going to take care of it. And so that unbelief, you know, we need to see the unbelief here as not passive, but a very active rebellion, a very active, you know, disobedience, you know, as opposed to just saying, you know, well, they were kind of passive. So anyway, that's the setting with the Israelites. God had provisions for them, had called them, had brought them, had it all set up, and they refused to go forward. And you know, you can come up with, well, you know, I'm not trying to say you couldn't come up with somewhat reasons you can identify with them. I mean, I can identify with them. They're like, I'm not a warrior. Those guys look like warriors. But God had already shown them he can take care of it all without them doing anything. So anyway, that's the setting with Israel. Any thoughts or comments or insights or other things you want to bring into the stories?
Seems like they already fought one battle with Amalek. Coming through the wilderness.
I don't know if they have at this point, but they may have.
And I remember because it's their first battle, and it's before they get to the promised land.
It may be.
Because the Lord says...
is that because they have one where they won't, you know...
The Lord says, you won't fight. I will fight for you.
So it should be in Numbers, so we should be able to look through the first 13 chapters and find it. And the first very part just sets up how they're organized. Well, it could be in Exodus, but I don't remember. There's the quail. Chapter 11.
It's also in Exodus.
It's in Exodus 14.
That's early.
Exodus 14 and verse 15. The Lord said unto Moses, wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. But lift up thy rod and stretch out thy hand over the sea.
No, that's the Red Sea.
The Red Sea.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's got to be late in Exodus. If it's in Exodus.
Yes, there's manna and quail in Exodus 16.
Yeah, I know it.
Here we go. Exodus 17. The Amalekites attack.
Okay, so it's early then. So they have had that also then.
And they were told to stand still, and the Lord would take care of it.
So is that a confirmation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, this is when Moses holds his hands up and makes the veil, and whenever his hands drop.
So they have two examples of war when they're not warriors and they won without being warriors.
They're under man. Mm-hmm.
And that they actually had to fight in that one, mm-hmm. Right? But the first one, they don't fight at all. They just watch.
First time they don't fight.
They just walk across dry land and watch them get swept over. Yeah. So they, you know, that's the thing is, you know, you can come up with, well, we know they've been, he said they tested me these 10 times. So in each of those tests, they saw miracles. And this wouldn't necessarily be a test. But so we know they have 10 plus tangible, concrete times they saw God intervene. But at least two military times that God has intervened. So, I mean, it's perfectly understandable to me why they are fearful. I have no problem with that. But being fearful and refusing to follow, you know, it's rebellion, it's disobedience. And that's the important part for the story. It's not like they wander in the wilderness because they were afraid or because they passively didn't believe. It's because they refused, because they disobeyed, because they rebelled. So that's the situation with the people. And then he talked about Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't know if that was the second one. That was the third one. Second one, the angels. And it's definitely not chronological here. Any of this, you know, he's not putting it together chronologically per se. Now, the fun part with the angels is, you know, even with the story in Egypt, do you notice how it wasn't, I mean, could you have more clearly stated what the reference was? I mean, it says a people. It doesn't even say Israel. I would feel pretty confident that's the correct reference. The deal with the angels is, when did this occur? And you end up with, you know, some views that you have to get into with some interpretation, and that is always debated on whether that's the what really is the reference. So the two general places you have to be on this, it seems, or, you know, I'm sure somebody deserves a third somewhere, but, you know, how things go. One is that the reference is to the fall of angels. And that one makes a lot of sense. It fits well until you get into this part about them being, you know, kind of some kind of prison. And that doesn't really fit very well. It's like, where did that happen? Because why are they free? The other one would be in Genesis 6, where, you know, before the, you know, the time of the flood, where... And you know, you have this group, these people, or I don't want to say people, that's all right, these identifiable, how can I say, I don't want to say creatures, and I don't want to say persons, because I don't want to, if I can say, use the word persons without saying that they're necessarily humans, these beings, I guess I should say, these beings have... you know, cohabitate with these women. And so the question becomes, is that a reference to, you know, like giants, or is that a reference to angels? And so that may be the case. So we can look at that in Genesis, I think it's Genesis 6. But this one is never, of the three accounts, this is the one that will have the most uncertainty, because it depends on interpretation of other passages rather than identifying which passage is being referred to. In chapter 6, it says, "Now it came about, when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives of themselves, whomever they chose." And so the question is, who are the sons of God? Even like Ryrie, I mean, I'll just read Ryrie's notes. He says, "Sons of God, here's the possibilities according to Ryrie. One, a godly line of Seth. Two, ungodly kings. Three, a group of fallen angels." So those are the three possibilities that Ryrie gives in his notes. And then he says, Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his day shall be 120 years. The Nephilim, and so then again we come to who are the Nephilim? Is that a, you know, referring back to the sons of men? And so we have, you know, this aspect. But the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children of them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Now, and then it goes on, it says, Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You know, that is, you know, is a statement that we shouldn't overlook real easily, or just, I mean, not overlook, but read over real quickly. I mean, this is talking about people. And even if it's general, not talking about each and every person, but this is generally true, even if we took it that way, that it's, you know, kind of an overstatement, but it's generally true that every intent of the thoughts of man's heart, the people that are alive, was continually evil. Continually evil. I mean, you think about, I mean, who does that, make, put everybody on earth kind of an idiot mean? Or, I mean, just continually evil. I mean, you think about, who are those people that their thoughts are continually evil? Not that they have evil thoughts. They're continually evil. I mean, that's a bad situation. So here we have one that makes sense in this passage for a lot of reasons. I mean, it kind of gives an explanation to why the flood would have been important or necessary. I shouldn't say important, necessary. Is that these angels cohabitated with women. I mean, angels somehow were able to take on physical form or indwell somehow into people. And you have this offspring that now is, it's, you know, it's totally goofed up this plan of salvation, because you have, you know, this kind of mixed breed of angels and people. And so it's, you know, part of the reason for the flood isn't, you know, it isn't just like, well, God decided to start over with Noah, but that things had, you know, it's not just that people were so corrupt morally, but the corruption was more than just morally. That would, you know, there's something to that. But at the same time, you can see that it is an issue of interpretation. Because it says sons of God, it doesn't have this. It doesn't tell us, okay, now, here, you know, angels that used to be good angels, and when, you know, when Lucifer fell, these angels fell, and some of them, you know, came up with this bright idea, and, you know, that it doesn't say that. So I'm not saying that's not what it is saying. I'm just saying that's an issue of interpretation. And so that makes this one of the three accounts much more difficult. But then you,
there's also the story where the Sadducees bring up to Jesus there was one wife, seven sons, seven brothers. The first one died, on and on. And he says, "You do err, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven."
Yeah.
And it kind of
like they couldn't have done that.
Well,
see, that's the whole thing. I mean, they couldn't have done it as spirits. That's obvious. They couldn't have been spiritual beings doing this. So somehow they had to take on human flesh. So how did they get the human flesh? Did they indwell, such as a demon indwells? Though it seems to be more than that.
But it still would be just the demon-possessed person's DNA passing on.
Not the demons. Yeah. So that makes it difficult. But you also have in Peter a passage where Peter talks about Let's see.
First?
Yeah, if I could find it.
First Peter?
I think it's in First Peter, isn't it? About the the angels and in prison. Maybe it's Second Peter. Maybe it's not Peter. Second Peter 2:4. Second Peter 2:4. But if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the angel of the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, and if he condemned the cities of Gomorrah. So there's some similarity between this and Jude in terms of talking about, you know, God's judgments. But notice here he talks about the angels when they sinned, but they were cast into hell. Now, in Matthew, it says that hell was created for Satan and his angels. But here it says they were cast into it, and they were committed to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment. Because we know from other accounts, I mean, assuming that demons are fallen angels, well, then these demons were loose. But here Peter's making a reference to some that are not loose. So that, you know, so is that what happened to these in the time of Noah, that the judgment came upon them? They so violated God's law in a way that not even other fallen angels did, that they were not even allowed to be to whatever freedom demons have, that they've been placed into a prison. So anyway, it's a very, you know, fun exercise because you have references, but the references involve making interpretation as opposed to it being extremely straightforward.
Because Satan didn't get thrown in the pit.
I know.
Well, and, you know, of course, we all have fun thing with the word worse, and we're talking about sins, because, you know, are there degrees of sins? And there's some things to suggest that. On the other hand, it makes us think, well, how could there be? Because sin is sin. Yeah, there's something. There's a group here that appears to be in prison while others are not. That's assuming demons are fallen angels, and you know, I don't know that you know, you have some issues there. Oh, I mean, as far as you know, you have to, you know, those are kind of interpretive things. So, yeah, it appears that I don't want to say it's worse, because you know, I don't know that you can have a worse sin than the first sin that causes all this chaos, but there's something about whatever these guys in a very generic sense did, you know, really, really got things fouled up. And if it is that,
God knows that Satan's going to really screw things up.
Yeah. So.
It seems like it's a situation where what they are doing is sufficient that they need to be bound at that moment.
Yep, true.
More fully than Satan needs to be bound.
Yeah, you know, which he will be eventually, but yeah. And so there's a, I guess you want to put it another way, is that Satan's sin, you know, started this whole ball game, but these guys broke the rules of the ball game, not necessarily the rules that started the whole chaos. Now the challenge here is, you know, what is Jude referring to? And we can come to a conclusion, but we'll never be able to come to a conclusion that that you that I think you could ever just be dogmatic and say, oh, without a doubt, this is it. But of all the situations we can come up with, what is clear, they all involve rebellion. No matter how which one you're going to take, it's rebellion. So once again, when it's talking about they didn't believe or they disobeyed, it's this act of disobedience, this act of rebellion against God. And then the last one is the Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah story. And so we need to find it. And so now we're even going,
Genesis.
We're not going further back, but we're shortly after the other story, actually. And so he didn't have a purpose to be chronological, but he's actually looked at three different groups or situations. And if you think of that as groups of people, one was he picked, and maybe that's intentional and why I didn't say Israelites, but one is he picked a group of people that, you know, had been identified as God's people. Then he picked a group of angels that were a different creation on a different order, but yet had rebelled. And now it's a city that's not identified as being believers, you know, but just people and their rebellion. And their rebellion is a little different. It's not so much a, you know, like we believe it. You know, in one sense, it's hard to say you rebel against God when you don't believe God exists. I mean, you know, rebellion typically is against, when we use the word rebellion, it's against something established, you know, that rules established, those, you know, whatever it is. But yet, you know, you have to bring in this whole thing. Is there something innate that people have some awareness of God? And there are these aspects there. So anyway, this group, you know, following, you know, the growth of things, then you have people that end up in places. So you have in verse 18, or chapter 18, says, now the Lord appeared to him, and in him here is Abraham, I guess, by the oaks of Mira, and while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day, when he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And he saw them, he ran from the tent to meet them, and bowed down, etc. Let's see. So anyway, this has, we're not going to read all that, but in the end up, you end up with Abraham had been in one place and Lot in another, and you go through this whole thing where God says that he's going to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abram, in verse 23 of chapter 18, Abram came near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50? And you know, and the Lord says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And it, anyway, it keeps on going down until he gets to what, 10? Is that what the story goes? You know, he keeps doing this. And so, with evidently, Abraham was confident that within Lot's family that there were 10 people. And I mean, that seems to be the case. I mean, if not, why did he stop at this point? Well, anyway, in chapter 19 it says, now the two angels came to Sodom In the evening, as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom, when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way. They said, however, No, but we shall spend the night in the square. Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. And, you know, the word relation, I think, it's been a while since I looked this bad. I think that'd be the same word. And so New American Standard clearly implies we're talking about sexual relation. We say we have relations with them. Where if it was the word no, it could be more in a sense of, you know, an interaction. But we know the word, that word is used in places in Scripture. You know, it's kind of that word for intercourse, which could be used in certain contexts for a verbal exchange, not just your, or it could be, you know, sexual. And so that becomes, you know, an issue in this passage is what is meant there. And so they're asking that question. And Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him. And he said, Please, my brother, do not act wickedly. Now, there would be some, you know, I mean, evangelical community most likely is to take this passage as that this is a very depraved society, and they are looking to have sexual, the men of the city are looking to have sexual relation with these guys, these two newcomers to town. Those that want, you know, that are going to maintain that sexuality is not in view here and not really an issue in the Bible, would, you know, highlight things like you have, you know, this city that's, you know, people are being diligent to protect their city, and you had two strangers come, and they're like, hey, who are these strangers? We need to know about these guys. That, you know, are these spies or these people that are trying to undo our city and so forth. And so at that point, you could see, well, yeah, that could be the case, and that would make sense. But where does the act wickedly come from? You know, I mean, if people were just like, hey, we need to protect ourselves, let's, you know, we want to inquire and stuff, you kind of have to wonder, why is he saying don't act wickedly? Now, behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you do with them whatever you like. That one gets even more bizarre. But the whole thing that it wasn't looking, it didn't have anything sexual aspects to it. Then this makes no sense at all. Now, I can't understand this from any, you know, standpoint of like, I'm sorry, two guys I don't know came to my house. Eric and Megan are standing inside. But, you know, having said that, I mean, I can't imagine offering my daughters, but I'm not letting two guys go out either. I mean, this is kind of like the old West, you know, when they want to, they got the guy in the jail, and all the mob is outside going to break into the jail, and the sheriff's the only one stands away, and he steps out the door with his shotgun and says, you know, even though you're my neighbors, I'm going to shoot you if you try to come in here. That's kind of the setting. I mean, it's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. And so the only way to make sense of this passage, which still to me, I struggle with it all, you know, there's no way I can really comprehend it, is that the protection of a foreigner, you know, a guest coming to your home was so high that you would have made this. And you know, is there some hyperbole there? That's definitely that you're, you know, I mean, that's not what they're after anyway. And so he knew they weren't, but he's just making this point. I don't know. I mean, I can never say I really understand that statement in any fullness or could identify with it. But I don't know how, at this point, it's really hard for me not to see that this is talking about sexual relationships.
When you get a little further after the destruction, when they get their father drunk and get pregnant by him, you think, how in the world could they do that? Well, you look back and dad.
That attitude.
The whole thing, their family fabric.
Yeah. Well, and he went there to be prosperous, and, you know, so he was, and they lived among this. You know, I mean, once again, you know, talk about dysfunctional family. They lived among this. And then also, you know, to what level, you know, I mean, if you read that passage and say, oh, they're just trying, you know, it's like just they were wanting to have fun, that would be one thing. And that would make it really bizarre. Not that this makes it less bizarre, but maybe more understandable, is that this whole idea of, well, we need to have, you know, children, and this is, you know, the only way to do it or something, but it's still very strange. But anyway, so they end up leaving the city with all this crazy stuff going on. And so the angel, verse 15, they urged Lot saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon them. And they brought them out and put them outside the city. Now, of course, it goes through and, you know, the wife looked back and so forth, which is clearly a part of this story, but not necessarily what Jude is referring to. But here you have, why are these people... You know, what is Sodom and Gomorrah about? Why is the destruction coming? And it is already told us, you know, I mean, every, you know, morally corrupt, you know, this. And so it's a different rebellion here, though. They were not in any, like Israel was in a relationship with God, some type of relationship, as a covenant community they were, and they had seen God interact. Or God, you know, performed. The angels, if it's the Genesis 6 and they had intervened, well, they're not believers, but yet they clearly had a concept of God. I mean, they were aware who God was, and they're in a battle with God. This group here is not has a definable battle, because I doubt if any of them believed that Yahweh was God. But that doesn't change the part that people still in that situation rebel against God. It's just like when you're saying you're an unbeliever. Well, 2 Thessalonians says you're being disobedient to the gospel. It's not just that you're passively. So you have rebellion in three different, I don't know, categories necessarily, but three different situations that are radically different. And Jude is brought, you know, bringing those into his setting. So next week, we just need somebody to bring to us a very clear, authorized, succinct conclusion on the Genesis 6 and the angels, and which is the right way to take that. And if you can do that, if somebody will do that in like 3 minutes, we'll be happy.
And what, next week we'll solve the...
Well, that's the way Jude comes across it. We'll solve it.
Okay, good.
You know, we're going to solve anything Jude talks about. We're.
Well, then, are we also going to find out how to get our wives to do what we want?
Is that in Jude?
I don't know, but it's one of those impossible.
But it's got to be in Jude. We're only dealing with Jude. We're only dealing with Jude. There might be Jude too.
We're going to study that book you wrote later, remember?